So there was a convention that we went to every year in, you know, just outside of Salt Lake City, but it was at a ski resort that was, they were like giving away rooms during the summer for whatever reason, despite the fact that it's absolutely gorgeous.
Yeah.
It's amazing. It still looks picturesque. You can still go up to the top of the mountain and see this beautiful vista. But for whatever reason, in summer in Utah, they're just like, I don't know, whatever. If it ain't snowing, who gives a shit?
Yeah, it just makes me wonder why we don't have vacancy taxes, like why we are allowing 1,000 housing units to be just sitting here empty. Because I was talking, I took a gondola ride yesterday by myself. I actually ran it a couple times. And I was talking to one of the guys that runs the gondola, and he was saying that he has to drive an hour each way to do this job. And yet I'm sitting here amidst all this empty housing. It's just this bizarre thing that we do, allowing the rich people to just have multiple properties that just sit there while the workers have to drive for hours. It's just, yeah, it's been fascinating to be here.
We should seize the houses, right, Heaton?
We should absolutely seize the houses. Yes. Viva la proletariat. I generally think that if we're going to put a burden on society, we should put it on society rather than individual people. So I'm forever fighting the good fight to try and get overzoning done, as I think that that's a significant part of why the housing shortage occurs. And insofar as the supply side goes, I'd say that we ought to be using taxes to build affordable housing, or specifically like city controlled housing for people that would otherwise be chronically homeless. But I'd rather do that than try to penalize people that you know have we my family has this beat up old cabin in Wagner that I'd love for you all to visit me at, but I don't think we should be penalized for not living in it year round, and I don't think that we're hurting the local community by doing that. If anything, we're you know, bringing in a little bit more money than would be there otherwise.
Yeah, but this is like an entire city that's empty. Like, this does hurt the local community, and it certainly hurts the workers who can't live anywhere near they work. Like, I can understand like a house here and there.
Yeah.
It's a ski community, isn't it? Like, it exists because of skiing.
Yeah, it does. But to have all this housing, there's people that live here, but they can't right. live here because these rich people are property hoarding.
But if there weren't, if it didn't have that external person coming in during ski season, then the community wouldn't be there at all.
I don't know about that. All I know is that like, there's a lot of housing that's been built here and no one living in it. And how many other communities are like this, where it's just properties that are built to sit and wait for the rich to come and play for, you know, 7 days out of the whole year. It's just, it's amazing.
Where are the rich allowed to hoard houses? That's what I want to know. We're just going to chase them around the world, and each new place they'll say, oh, this is the new rich place to go, and they'll all buy houses. And then all of a sudden, unfair Jennifer Briney's going to come in and bully them out of their peaceful little nook.
No, not bully them out of it, but perhaps incentivize them to allow people to live here the other 50 weeks out of the year, instead of just having this collection of housing while the rest of us have our costs go up and up and up. And I've just never seen a whole city abandoned like this. It's just
weird.
You've
never been to like an off-peak vacation town?
No, I absolutely have. I love going to places off peak, but there's usually people there, like people like me, but there's no one here because it's all these private residences. It's bizarre. It's just a very strange vibe because like you walk around here and there are these restaurants. There's this great bar that's in the middle of a field and they have all the lawn games and stuff out there, but there's no bartender and there's no people in there. It's just completely empty. And yet it's pre-Labor Day. In the summer, like I get that a lot of the kids have gone back to school, but it's empty, you guys. It's so weird. It's just weird. And I'm just having thoughts about it. That's all.
This is a wonderful touchstone for how we approach topics or how we approach problems. Jen, I think you're much more concerned with evenly dividing the pie, whereas I'm more concerned with growing the pie. So I just want to have more houses. But I think that this is just how our different orientations tend to line up, where, you know, let's figure out how to divide the sum total of houses. And I'm like, build more houses.
Yeah, but what makes this place so special is right now I'm staring upon these unspoiled hills. Like, you need to have open space. And so having this solution be, oh, just like mow down more open space and build more units
Hell
for rich
yeah.
people to own and never spend time in. Like, I just don't think that's the right solution, because you're going to spoil places like this by building 1,000 units in the middle of it for no reason. Like, there could be 20 housing units for the number of people that are here year round. It's just crazy. That's all.
Heaton, how has Fringe Festival been?
It's been nice. It's wrapped up now. Edinburgh is going back to sleep. And so everybody's left. I'm still here, but most of the comedians have gone back to London or from wherever they hail. It's kind of nice, actually. I like it because now I just get to go back to hanging out with my Scottish friends. There's less, I feel less pressure to go out and do stuff every day. So I can just get some work done and then go dick around with my friends, Dickie and Stone.
When are you more the token American? When the Fringe Festival is not in town or when it is in town?
I think when it's not in town, when it is in town. Because
you're a real oddity. You're like somebody owns a Bengal tiger when there's fewer people around, right?
Yeah, when the Fringe is in town, there's not a lot of Americans over here. I think just because there's not a lot to be gained. It's wonderful if you want to come over for the experience, but most of the people that are here with the career ambitions are hoping to get picked up by the BBC. And if I knocked it out of the park and had a show, I couldn't do that because I'm not legal to work in the United Kingdom. So there don't tend to be a lot of Americans here. So when the Fringe departs, then it goes back to where I am the one American in whatever social group I'm in, and become the touchstone for all things American, either for good or for ill.
I would imagine that the locals give driving directions based on where you are. Just like, just head down there and make a right at the tall American.
You'll see a fella in a suit that doesn't need to be in one. It's only him.
Speaking of Americans and friend groups, I'm a little disappointed that my Austin friend group had absolutely no reaction whatsoever to me telling them that I'm coming back to Austin. None. Not even a heart emoji from you two. What the hell?
Forgive me. One, scatterbrain during the Fringe. Two, Jen, it's gone from Jen not being there to the universe being restored to its normal right state.
Yeah.
And so everything's just clicked back into place as it should be. And that is, I think, where our minds are. Ah, good. Life has returned to normal now that Jen is returning.
Yeah.
Also, the fact that I'm not in Austin at the moment makes it hard for me to abstractly interpret you coming to Austin.
It's hard for me to do that. I don't believe it. I don't believe it until it happens. All of my fair weather friends, they leave and then they say they're going to come back. I'll believe it when they actually get into town. Otherwise, it'll be something else. Oh, I saw a commercial about Bali, and so now I'm going to be there for 9 months or whatever. Like, that's, I don't know. When you guys get back in, then we'll celebrate.
All right, fair enough.
From Austin, Texas, I'm Justin Robert Young from Utah.
Park City, Utah, to be exact, and I'm Jennifer Briney.
And from Edinburgh, Scotland,
I'm Andrew Heaton.
And we're not wrong on this edition of the program. We're going to talk about campaign finance and a new lawsuit that is kicking around federal court that could fundamentally reshape how campaigns are funded, even as soon as the 2024 cycle, and the Maui fires, specifically the fact that Maui County has sued the Hawaiian Electric Company. That is the second time that a massive fire has been followed by lawsuits against a utility. We discuss the future of these organizations. That in your emails. But let's talk about campaigns, shall we? Party activists are rubbing their hands in anticipation of the relaxation of campaign finance laws, specifically erasing the limits of what party committees can spend on congressional races. Under existing campaign finance reform, the National Republican Congressional Committee and the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee can spend between $59,000 and $119,000 in coordination with their candidates for those races. The National Republican Senatorial Committee and the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee can spend between $119,000 and $3.6 million. But beyond that, party committees must rely on independent expenditure operations, known as IEs. Essentially, they're just spending the money and they cannot legally coordinate with the campaign. So it's kind of the way that super PACs work. independent expenditure arms require that degree of separation, and their staff cannot coordinate with candidates or those in the organization. They communicate often through code in so-called red boxes or hidden public websites, which is a whole nother thing that if you are talking on a message board back and forth on a website that technically the URL is accessible by everybody, but is not listed or searchable anywhere, that is technically not coordinating. Still, candidates are offered cheaper rates for advertising than committees. So dollar stretches further when it is going through the official campaign organization. Erasing these coordinated spending limits would aggrandize the party committees for both the Democrats and Republicans. Super PACs, however, would remain largely unaffected. This legal challenge is currently working its way through the courts and could eventually end up in the Supreme Court. A reminder that in 2022, according to Open Secrets, the National Republican Senatorial Committee raised $250 million, while the National Democratic Senatorial Committee raised $298 million. So this is no small change, $250 million for each party. Andrew Eaton, should these campaigns be able to coordinate freely with the campaign committees?
Yeah, I think so. Let's quickly talk about whether this is actually going to come to pass or not, which I'm kind of doubtful on. I've not read through the briefing that they filed in the attempt to overturn this law, so I could be wrong about this, but it doesn't seem to me that they've got much of a shot of overturning Valeo B. Buckley or Citizens United in such a way as to do this. Quick crash course for people. Buckley v. Valeo, was like a 1976 decision that affirmed the ability for Congress to regulate the campaign contributions to candidates and to parties and to cap them. So the Supreme Court said that there is a legitimate role for the state to stop corruption or the appearance of corruption, specifically with things that are or appear to be quid quo pro. Hence, I cannot give $50,000 to the Justin for Congress campaign as the American Corn Growers Union for fear that that would be a way of bribing Congressman Justin to help corn tariffs or alternately make people think that and lose respect for the system. You jump forward to Citizens United. Citizens United says that super PACs are an independent entity. They're not run by the candidate, which is true. Therefore, we don't have to worry about quid quo pro. And we've had more and more money go into super PACs over time. I don't see a reason that this would overturn Buckley v. Valeo. So I'm not sure that this is going to happen. But were it to happen, I don't think it would be a bad thing. I'm not particularly worked up about it and that I don't think that this would be a huge watershed either way. But I'm of the opinion that most of the campaign restrictions that we've put in place over the last 30 years have been counterproductive and have backfired. So we put laws in right before Nixon, but specifically right after Nixon, which said that you as a citizen or a union or a corporation or whatever, you can donate however much money you want to political speech, but in a kind of buffet style thing, you can't give an unlimited amount to any particular vehicle for campaign speech. So I could give $5 million in a campaign year, but I can't give it all to one thing. I'm limited in the amount of money that I can give to a candidate. I'm limited in the amount of money that I can give to a party. And that's had, I think, multiple bad effects that have resulted from trying to erect these firewalls. One is that we've just pushed all the money into super PACs, where back in the day, if you had a candidate that was honorable in how they maintained their campaign, and I'm usually fairly skeptical of Bernie Sanders, but to his credit, I think he generally runs clean campaigns and he wants to not have character attacks. And he did fire somebody in his last campaign that started doing character attacks, which I think is laudable. And we would have better American political discourse if that happened. But as it is, by putting these caps in place, by putting these firewalls in place, we've pushed more and more money away from the campaign itself that's controlled by the candidate, where they get to speak for themselves and how they want the campaign to manifest. We've taken it out of their hands and put it in unaffiliated allied forces that can be vicious and mean. Think like Swift Boat veterans against John Kerry, stuff like that. That's been a a bad event in my mind, because it didn't actually do anything in terms of limiting the amount of money that goes into the political process. It didn't do anything to limit the amount of political speech. All it does was remove the ability of the candidate to control the narrative in favor of the candidate, which I think was a bad step. And then the other thing that happened was right now, the amount of Americans that give money to political campaigns ever is about 3%. 97% of Americans do not donate money to political campaigns. So if you've got a very small amount of people that are inclined to give money to a campaign, and you can only get small contributions from people, you're limited to whatever it is per candidate, $5,000 or $12,000 to the party. I don't remember the exact numbers. What you end up doing is trying to go for small dollar donations, which is to say we've structurally incentivized the process to be populist, i.e. Bernie Sanders or Donald Trump or anything where it's small stuff. And we also have very much incentivized it to be angry, because if you're trying to motivate lots of people to give small donations, the best way to do that is to peddle outrage. And so I think that these donation caps that have been put in place have ended up facilitating much of the political rancor that we're currently doing. And regardless of whatever their intent was, they've been counterproductive. And if we're really worried about the influence of money in politics, the place to start is in Congress in terms of how committee chairmanships are apportioned, and just make it a rule. They could do it right now. It doesn't require a constitutional amendment. It doesn't even require making a law. We can make a rule saying that committees just elect their own chairs. We could focus on getting rid of gerrymandering. We could focus on all the things we talk about regularly, ranked choice voting, open primaries, all those things. Those would be far, far, far better ways to influence the electoral system. And so if this ends up getting washed away and committees within a party can coordinate with the candidates, I see no downside to it. And I'm inclined to think that we've gone too far in the first place.
Which, by the way, to put a fine point on your chairmanship topic, these are the committees that the speakers and leaders of either party in Congress, this is the thing they're raising money for. So like Nancy Pelosi being a fundraising powerhouse in the Democratic Party, it was because she was filling the coffers of the Democratic Campaign Committee, the Congressional Campaign Committee. This is the fund where all that money goes and then gets apportioned. But how it gets apportioned is up for debate. Jen, what do you think?
Well, I mean, as you, Justin, explained so well, they're already getting around these limits. So, I mean, yes, Making it official, like, I can't muster any reason to care. I think it's a bigger picture issue. The fact that massive amounts of money are going into our elections, it's kind of money that's being set on fire. So much of it goes from candidates or political committees or the parties straight to the media. Our election cycles are never ending. So I just feel like,
hell yeah.
Ugh, Justin, I just feel like if we wanted to combat the issue of our politicians constantly feeling like they have to raise money as opposed to doing their actual jobs, I think shortening our elections is probably a good place to start. So to say, I don't know, maybe limit our election to like 6 months or something, where, because so much of this money goes to ads. I don't know how to do this, but one of the things that really bothers me about our system is that we have politicians that are elected to 2-year offices and they spend so much of their time dialing for dollars. And whether it's the head of the party or it's the candidates themselves, they're elected to govern and instead they're raising money. And it's hurting our country in a very fundamental way. Now, what to do about it? If only I knew. I have no idea. But this is just another symptom of our entire election system being based on money instead of courting votes in a policy way. So I don't know. But the court case, I don't really care either way.
To the point on the amount of money that congressmen are constantly raising. It's true that they're spending a lot of their time raising money, but it's not in order to win the election or to maintain their incumbency. There's very low turnover between parties in the United States. In 2020 and in 2016, it was similar, which we think of as big watershed years. I looked this up a couple of years ago. In 2020, the amount of party swapping in the Senate, Congress, gubernatorial and state legislatures in the United States was about 7% turnover from party to party. That is to say that in 2020, 97% of the elected offices in the country, I'm not including things like county commissioner and stuff like that, but broadly speaking, the elected positions, 97% were retained by whatever party had them prior, 93% was maintained by whatever party had them prior to the election. So we have very low turnout or low turnover. So what the money's being raised for in all these things is to gain clout within the party and to get a better position within Congress. The reason that people are raising money is, as Justin said, and as Jen alluded to, because if I raise a bunch of money, I am more apt to get a chairmanship within my committee, or I'm apt to get a committee that I want to be on. And the way to deal with that, I don't think we can really do anything in terms of capping money on the supply end. The way to do that is to alter the incentive structure within Congress itself, which we could do, and which weirdly enough would be easier to do than a lot of legislation that has been proposed in terms of campaign finance reform. In terms of limiting elections, I think there's something to that, Jen. The British do that in a form because they don't have regularly scheduled elections like us. They have a time frame that they have to call an election in. And the prime minister says, I don't know the exact thing. Let's say they have to do it within a 5-year period or something like that.
They blow an old horn and ring a bell. And then, of course, there's the releasing of the Beagles. And at that point, there is now 6 months to vote for somebody.
So there are some places that do that, but I think that we could drill down a little bit further to a kind of basic element of governance that's going to apply to any solution we come up with, which is this: Congress can legislate incentives. It cannot legislate intent. So if you very much have the intention of, God damn it, I want to be in the Senate and I'm running for Senate, Congress can literally make absolutely no difference whatsoever on your desire to do that. And your ability to begin acting as though you're running a campaign years in advance is not something that Congress can do anything about. And so if I don't formally declare myself a candidate until 6 months before the election, there's nothing to stop me from spending the 3 years prior to that meeting with every single pancake breakfast in my county, or going to schools or going to the local school boards. I think that there's really nothing you can do that would outlaw campaigning. That is going to be there. And the bigger we have a government with spending, the more people are going to be involved in that process. So I think trying to compel people's behavior in terms of what they ought to do or what they want to do in regards to running for office is a losing battle. And the way to modify what's happening is the incentive structure within Congress itself and the electoral mechanisms for democracy, a la open primaries and ranked choice voting.
I'm totally down with that suggestion. I think it's a really, really good one. And I also think that you bring up a really good point, which is that if you have a democracy in which there's so little turnover, and when there is turnover, it's just between these two parties, I don't think it's a good sign for the health of our democracy. Because I've also looked up in the past every election, I do my post-election special on Congressional Dish, and I'm always stunned that it's well over like 96-97% every time in Congress is either Democrats or Republicans. I mean, right now, I can't think of a single independent in the House. And in the Senate, we have Angus King and Bernie Sanders. Other than that, they're all in the duopoly.
Kyrsten Sinema.
Is she an independent now?
Yeah, yes. She's an independent. Yeah.
Okay, whatever. So we have three out of 535.
Oh, it's not so excited about independence now, are you, Jen?
I don't know. It's fine that she's an independent. It's just we've got a total of three. No, yeah. I don't hate her, actually. I find her outfits to be one of the most entertaining things on C-SPAN 2.
I'm with you. Work, girl.
Yeah, she's fun. But my point is, this amount of money and the way it gets funneled to the parties, we have two parties that have really rigged the rules in their own favor, whether it comes to the debates or gerrymandering or how they do committees, all of it. And I think that's access. Something ballot access. Exactly.
Ballot access is a big thing, but also how much do we want these places to change? I mean, how much are we expecting? is that honestly, the reason why some districts are Republican, some districts are Democratic is because that's the culture of the district for which is there.
I beg to differ with that. I think that there's a great mirage that is happening in the United States. As people in the show know, I'm from Oklahoma. I believe there's 5 different congressional districts right now at this time. They are all Republican. You would infer from that and from the electoral map in presidential elections that Oklahoma is overwhelmingly Republican and conservative, given just how many Republicans represent it over the last 25 years. When you start looking at the voter registration and you start looking at the actual amounts, it's like 60-40. Which is still a heavy majority, but that does mean that a little less than half of the people in Oklahoma are Democrats. But we treat it as though it is a complete red tidal wave every time because of the electoral system that we've put in place. Something that we could do, this I borrow from Lee Drutman, who's been on the Political Orphanage before, is let's say you had one big at-large district in the state of Oklahoma where it's just 5 congressmen for the entire state and everybody votes on them and we just send the top 5 people there. You would probably see an electoral map that is more emblematic of the people, which is to say that there would be 3 Republicans, 2 Democrats, and an independent. And that would be a more accurate reflection of the constituency itself. Right now, we're living in a system that is ideologically gerrymandered in much the same way that we live in a system in much of the country that is geographically gerrymandered. And it does it to create these outcomes. But I do not think that they're actually reflective of the constituency itself.
Yeah, and I want to add to that
I think you're overstating that.
Well, I think we also have to keep in mind that half of the people in this country aren't registered as either Democrat or Republican, but we feel like we have to vote for one of them. So like for instance, I tend to, I vote in whatever way is going to be best for working people, right? And so technically you would think that I'd be one of the Democrats, although I don't know, things are changing. But they don't give a damn about workers. Like they're just as much governing in favor of bosses. Like there is no coalition in the Democratic or Republican parties that is truly governing on behalf of workers. And so like I am disenfranchised really when it comes to these two parties. And yet a lot of times I pick between the two of them because those are the only choices I've got. So I also think there's an illusion here that we're all split perfectly into red and blue. There's more factions in this country than 2, I guess is what I'm trying to say. And everyone who doesn't fit perfectly into Republican and Democrat, which in my experience is most of us, we're just picking the lesser of 2 evils.
Or the Republicans and the Democrats are broad coalitions that sometimes splinter and sometimes bleed even into each other. And that's just the way that we have organized ourselves. And now, look, I'm not saying, Heaton, that there's not room for electoral reform. And yes, I'm sure that if we turned a few dials and knobs, that all of America's humanity and political decision making would be totally different. It would be far more fair. But I think that it's usually a safe thing to assume that the way that we have self-organized has self-organized for a reason. And while certainly party chicanery and party graft and pulling the levers a little bit harder for your own advantage is also human nature and does come to pass, to think that we are only 2 changes away from fundamentally reshaping how happy or sad we are with our representation is foolhardy, in my opinion.
I don't think we're going to get to an electoral utopia. And I think in whatever system we live in, I'm always going to be the odd man out. Like when I'm here in the United Kingdom, they're like, what do you think you'd be? And I'm like, which one of the losers right now that don't do anything? And they're like, Lib Dems. And I'm like, I'd probably be fucking that. So like your point is taken. There's not going to be a situation where we do something and I snap my fingers and now it's a heat and friendly outcome, which incidentally is not what I'm trying to do. I'm not attempting to rig the game in a way that ends up with what I want. I'm trying to make the system more emblematic of the actual Democratic constituency therein. I think you'd still probably have the Republicans and the Democrats be the major players in town, but to your point, Justin, I think a lot of the umbrage that we have right now and a lot of the dissatisfaction that folks like me and Jen have is that historically you are correct. If we go back to 1965, the term Democrat and Republican were much more broad and much more ambiguous. If my daughter comes home, in this scenario, I'm 55 or something.
You're in 1965 and you have a daughter. Okay, gotcha.
Yes, I have a daughter, thank you. And she comes home and says, Papa, I'm dating a Republican. I would go, oh, Republican, you say? Well, do you mean like a liberal Republican, like Nelson Rockefeller?
All right. So Heaton is holding his hand upward as if he has a pipe in his hand. Everybody knows.
Is it a Rockefeller Republican? Or they're in the East Coast, a liberal Spanish speaking pro-gay Republican like Nelson Rockefeller? Is it a Western libertarian like Barry Goldwater, or a moderate like that George Romney fellow up in Michigan? And then you reverse the thing and Dad, I'm dating a Democrat. Now I'm the kid. And, gotcha. and the dad goes, well, what are you talking about? Like a bigot from the South, like one of those Dixiecrats, like Strom Thurmond or George Wallace that is actively agitating for the maintenance of segregation? Are you talking about a union thug up north? Or are you talking about an academic or a hippie out west? The term did not denote anything specific, because back in the day, whereas our European friends have elections and then they hold coalitions, we had a coalition and then we had an election. The functionally 5 to 6 parties that were composite within the Republican coalition and the 5 to 6 parties that were composite within the Democratic coalition would themselves hold a mini election, and they'd pick one of their composite parties and then they'd run it. But it didn't make a huge difference from election to election. The last 15, 20 years, starting around the late 90s, I guess 30 something years now, late 90s, there's a great ideological sort that happens within the country where there, if you're conservative, you're a Republican. If you're a progressive, you're a Democrat. If you're libertarian or a moderate, you're none of them. You're just leaving. And so the confines of those two big parties have shrunk. They're no longer big parties. They're much more small. They're much more restrictive. And the maneuverability that we once enjoyed within them has slimmed down enough that I don't think that your position today is a salient one.
See, I don't agree with that, because if you were to tell me like, oh, I'm a Republican, I would automatically be wondering like, are you a MAGA? Or are you a taxed enough already? Or like, if you're a Democrat, are you a AOC type, or are you a banker butt kisser like Jim Himes? Like, there are very different coalitions within these two parties, but there are things that bind them, as in they're both subservient to corporations and they're both down with never ending war. And there's just no way for those of us that want to vote against those things, there's nowhere for us to go. So I know that I would be much more satisfied if the Libertarians and the Greens, for instance, had an easier path to ballot access, because there's plenty of us that like what those two parties have to say, but they're locked out. So, and they agree on a lot. You know, there's a lot of us, especially if you're anti-war, that are looking at the Greens and Libertarians, because that's the coalition that would be representing us. But we have no electoral path, especially on the congressional level, to get those people in. And so that's why when we talk about like this massive amount of money that is being allowed to go to the parties, specifically the Democrats and Republicans, that's why it just feels like more of rigging the game, like, because those parties get to choose the candidates. And if you have that much money behind them, you're just incentivized to run within their structure and do what they want. It's just, that's where I think the money is corrosive.
Some of this also just feels like when people bitch about Marvel movies ruining movies, where it's like, oh yeah, because they're really popular. Or McDonald's ruining food. Yeah, because it's extraordinarily popular and it's what people want, and they are voting with their dollar to do it. The reason why the Republican and Democratic parties exist is because they help candidates win. That's why. Because it's easier to
gerrymander the maps. Like, no, it's sure, not that
yeah.
simple.
No, I mean, again, I'm not saying that this is outside of it, but this is in broad strokes, the reason why somebody who is politically motivated decides I'm going to align myself with one tribe or another and not run as an independent is not because they want to hew their beliefs to a convention based hodgepodge that comes up every 4 years. It's because they know, if a D or an R is next to my name, people will say, okay, well, he can't be that bad. He's clicked up with whatever gang. And the reason why the Libertarians and the Greens do not have more of a footprint is because they're unserious parties that don't actually try to do the blocking and tackling that is necessary to get people elected. If they were more electorally efficacious, they would be more of a force in this country. And we watched that happen with Ross Perot, who was a despite his own self-destructive failings for his presidential campaign, did create enough of a wave for which for a brief period of time, we had a third party in the Reform Party that won major statewide races like the governorship of Minnesota. So that is why are you shaking your head?
the rules have been changed. Like, if you're looking at the presidential level, ballot access, Jill Stein had all kinds of barriers put up towards her and being put on ballots. And then you also look at the presidential debates, which are really controlled by the Democrats and the Republicans together. And then you look at the congressional level, gerrymandering, like, it also ballot access in that regard too.
No labels was invented like as a concept. It was several years ago, but in terms of being a presidential force, it's really like less than a year ago, and they're going to have access on all 50 states. And for a candidacy that may or may not happen, it's not impossible.
Yeah, no labels, another corporate party.
Yes, it takes a lot of money. Yes, it takes lawyers, but it is not impossible to do it. And the libertarians have access on all 50 states. And they've run joke candidates. They're going to run a candidate that literally tells jokes this time.
I think you both can be right on this one. I think having spoken to people that are involved on the ballot access side, ballot access laws do intentionally try to stop anybody from bucking the two-party system in a number of states. There's a lot of laws that make it very easy. So I could be getting this wrong, but I believe in Massachusetts, the top two parties don't have to go get ballot signatures most of the time to appear on it. So if the previous election, you were one of the top two parties, you don't have to get signatures this time. I wonder who those two parties are going to be.
Yes.
Meanwhile, if you're a third party, you got to go get signatures and you've got a lot less financial resources and a lot less people. So they're trying to put speed bumps into them to make it non-competitive. So that is a thing. That being said, though, Justin, having been to a lot of libertarian events, I think a lot more people that are interested in philosophical activism than electoral success that frequently happens. I know Justin Amash has been beating this drum the last couple of years, and I've found that there are a lot of people that really want to write a manifesto and talk about it rather than go get elected for county commissioner.
Yeah.
So I think they could both be right. But to your earlier point, Justin, the Republican and Democratic parties are effective and popular vehicles to run for office. If theoretically I were running for office, I'm not. But if I were, I would think about running as a Republican or a Democrat, depending on where I was in, because my goal is to get elected. It would make a lot of sense. That being said, the fact that we've had mass amounts of defectors from both parties to becoming independent over the last 10 years, does that not indicate that they are deeply unpopular with a significant amount of the American people?
No, I would agree. I'm not saying that they're well run. I'm saying that they are the most two popular coalitions. I'm not saying that everything that they do is great. I'm not saying that everything they do is fair. I'm saying that right now, as we look at them, they are the broadest swath of political opinion in this country, aside from the most potent swath, the non-voting swath. And that's who I really want to be the voice for. Not voting is cool and awesome, and you should do it if you want to, and never be bullied into voting. Never let these losers in the Republican and Democratic parties or the Libertarians or the Greens bully you into voting. It is your right to not vote.
Oh, I will bully the shit out of you. You should always vote.
Stand up for yourself, not voters. Stand up for yourself. This is what tyranny looks like.
Justin,
I'm very much in favor of, I would love for it to be a norm that when we talk about the percentage of votes that a candidate gets, we're referring to the overall electorate and not to the people that actually showed up.
Yeah.
That way we say like, Congressman Mitchell, won by 17%. And we acknowledge the fact that everybody acts as though they have an overwhelming mandate, which is bullshit. If the new president coming in is a Democrat and I'm a Republican or vice versa, it's not like the people have collectively across the country decided we have to do whatever the president wants and I have to lay down my arms. It's my job to represent my district, and I'm going to keep doing that regardless of what the rest of the country said. And I also think it would be healthy for democracy and for people to realize just how few people are actually selecting and putting into office the people that are running the country. Because when we start looking at it going, it's actually like maybe 14 to 18% of voters that are making the decisions for this whole thing, it loses some of that magisterium, which for me is a good thing. So I would love for the non-voters to at least be on the map rather than discounted.
I love that idea, because that's also something that's completely under our control in the way we do our own shows. So that's a great idea, Andrew. And I think I might run with that.
I'm here.
So can I bring up something that we didn't touch on? I'm surprised by that, but I'm heartened by this.
Yeah.
Nobody on today's panel brought up the idea that money in campaigns uh, that that monetary contributions are the deciding factor in elections and that people are purchasing districts. And I'm glad that that didn't come up because per our earlier conversation about the incredible lack of turnover that happens from party to party, it would seem to me that monetary contributions to campaigns, be they well spent or ill-gotten, are not the determining factor, and they're a red herring. And I think that a lot of the campaign finance reform gets dumbed down into this very reductive and ultimately false idea that you can purchase elections in the United States and that that's what we should be focusing on. That's not how it works. I don't think that the math actually adds up. I think that there's correlation where the successful candidates end up raising more money, but I don't think that they just buy the election. And it would be far better for us to put our emphasis on the exact things we've been talking about: ballot access, gerrymandering, and how committees are done. The electoral mechanisms are something that are going to be more efficacious and account for a much more heavy lifting in terms of what's addling American democracy than campaign contributions.
I agree, especially because most of the money goes to ads. And first of all, you have to have a cable subscription to even see the ads. And so I often don't even see any ads. And even when I do, I'm making fun of them half the time. So it's like, unless you're being influenced by the ads, it's all money that's being set on fire. That's my biggest problem with it, is it's just money that's being set on fire that we could spend on better things. I mean, the last election, Justin, you would know better than me. Wasn't it over $1 billion that was spent
for
in the last
presidential
election?
For the presidential raise?
Yes. Yeah.
That's such a waste of cash.
If it makes you feel better, we waste our money on a lot of things. So
true.
the amount of money we spend on campaigns is about the same as what we spend on Halloween candy every year. if you add up Halloween candy and dog costumes, that's literally about what we spend on American elections. So while it is a waste of money, we apparently have enough money to throw around a lot of different things. So
yeah.
You shouldn't feel
too
bad
about it. We love giving our money away to these people. No, I don't. I don't give any money to these lunatics. Are you fucking high? Absolutely not. No, because here's the other thing. I don't mind them going to commercials. Commercials are at least their own weird form of art that you can appreciate and look back on old commercials. And it says something about trying to appeal to the American public in the way that looking back at an old, commercial where Fred Flintstone is selling cigarettes, it reminds you of a moment in time where things were different. Where I find the disgusting element of political expenditures is the consultants that don't do shit or tell you the same thing that ChatGPT could tell you. Like that's where a vast majority of this kind of money goes. At least the people who are making ads are putting ideas out there. Cause that's the one thing that you've said, which is we want people to get elected for their ideas. We want people to get elected for what they're going to do and then for touting their record on doing it or not doing it. And I do think that ads get us closer to that. I don't think that having a gigantic staff where everybody is just a bunch of sycophantic yes men or these poobahs who have this shamanistic sense of how the electorate's going to go, them getting overpaid is something that I think you could probably get that, replacement level talent would come cheaper for that product.
Justin, can you tell us why the fuck they're still around? Like, we've mentioned this on a previous show, but one of the things I thought was going to happen in 2016 when Trump won was that we would realize that most of the consultants don't know what they're talking about because they clearly didn't in that election. Trump ignored them and he won. Hillary listened to them and she lost. It seemed to me that was largely dead weight. And I thought that we were going to go, oh, these people are just flim-flam artists. This is, you don't need to give them money.
We'd never hear from Mark Penn again.
they all came back. They all came back.
Yeah.
So why is that? I got most of the time they're efficacious or what is it?
My sense of it from just, the cheap seats. Running a campaign is terrifying. You have a lot of money that shows up out of nowhere. Even the people that have done it for a while don't really know how to do it. And the vast majority of your staff is volunteer. So you are bringing people in off the street to do the actual work of calling, door knocking, blah, 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 blah. And also it's very rapidly scaling. So you start out getting a little bit of money and you need to prove that you can do X, Y, and Z. And then you get more volunteers. You're doing good in the polls. So then you get more money. More money comes in. Now all of a sudden you can hire more people. You have more volunteers that are doing it. So think of it like a startup that has no product and also has to spend all the money by the end of it and is not trying to be sustainable. It's a headache. It sucks to do. you are constantly blamed. And so that's why when people eat a load of shit, like people have done in various different elections, you're not really blamed for it all that much, because it's, hey, sometimes things break the other way. And at the end of the day, who's going to replace you? You're the one who's done it. And this is kind of a shit job. So that's why these people wind up coming back and doing it. People fixate on the ideological element of it, but at the end of the day, a lot of these people are a lot more ideologically flexible. And you've seen people that were extraordinarily establishment become slightly more progressive when they are running with more progressive candidates or trying to appeal to more progressive audiences, or vice versa. People that were progressive that then become more of a middle of the road moderate thing. But that's the reason why everybody gets recycled, is because it is a very, very rare skill set, and nobody, unless you're an absolute lunatic, like I would not want to do it. There's a reason why I like to talk about politics and I haven't gone into politics, because when you actually look at what the job is, well, boy, wow, does that stink.
So part of it is, it's not that this is just people with clipboards going, hey, America first rather than America greatly. It's not just the sort of branding experts. It's also the people that are actually, like, you're hiring somebody to run the volunteers. You're hiring somebody to coordinate the, okay. So there is, it's not just the branding people. There is a skill set for this. It's the professional electioneers that you're hiring.
You are doing a lot of stuff. Now, when you're at the very high level and you are hiring 9 people for every one job, then yeah, you get into a little bit more of a specialized world. And I don't think that campaigns have been better for it. And that's what Donald Trump showed, is that having one or two people making decisions can often be faster and more efficacious than having a gigantic group of 20 that are going to constantly debate everything forever. But yeah, a campaign is a lot of different people that have to do a lot of different things. There's a lot of moving parts that come to how you eventually get to it. And I think it can be reduced to what we see and where, you know, the heroes and villains of, like, what Jen's pointing out about Mark Penn. You know Mark Penn's name because he's a villain to the progressive left. You know, he is a villain to that. And that is why he is famous. It's not for what Mark Penn has done his entire career. It is for part of what he has done that is more publicly out there.
I don't know who Mark Penn is. Is this like
a Democratic strategist who's involved in a bunch of very failed campaigns?
He's just bad at his job.
Yeah,
that's what we know about him. But he still gets hired by people.
Yeah, because he's been to the mountaintop. Whether or not he's fallen down and broken his ankle and his pants fell down and everybody saw his dingling is a different story. He's still been to the mountaintop a couple times. Let's talk about our Patreon. Patreon.com/wherenotwrong is where you need to go to get a bonus episode of this show. A lot of Patreons will spread things out. You'll get a Patreon episode one day, and then a few days later, you'll get a main episode. That always frustrates me because I'll listen to one part of it, and then I'll be like, well, I don't want to stop listening. I want to listen to the rest of it. Well, guess what, guys? We don't pull that shenanigans. No, you get both of our episodes at the same damn time. It is one beautiful block of We're Not Wrong content for you, those that pony up and pay us money. And by the way, let's go ahead and take a look here right now. Patreon.com/WERENOTWORNG. We are at 940. We only need 60 more patrons to crack the 1,000 mark. I'm so excited and I just can't hide it. Patreon.com/WERENOTWRONG. Let's take it down a little bit. There's no good way to transition from a jaunty begging of money to the death of thousands, so we'll do it uncomfortably. Maui County has filed a lawsuit against the Hawaiian Electric Company following the fires in Lahaina that were reportedly sparked by the utility's power lines amid high winds and drought conditions. The fires, which resulted in the deaths of at least 115 people, have been deemed the deadliest in the United States in over a century. The lawsuit alleges that the utility failed to shut off power in the face of those conditions and neglected their duty to maintain their equipment and trim vegetation that would prevent such incidents. The fire occurred as Hurricane Dora passed near Hawaii. Hawaiian Electric, which caters to 95% of Hawaii's electric customers, expressed disappointment in the county's legal move while investigators are still investigating. The utility is facing other lawsuits, including one from its investors accusing it of fraud, by the way. Maui County's lawsuit highlights that other utility companies have procedures in place for power shutoffs during high-risk conditions and seeks compensation for damages. Other utilities have been found liable for devastating fires recently. In June, a jury in Oregon found the electric utility PacifiCorp responsible for causing devastating fires during Labor Day weekend in 2020, ordering the company to pay tens of millions of dollars to 17 homeowners who sued and finding it liable for broader damages that could push the total award into the billions. Meanwhile, Pacific Gas and Electric declared bankruptcy and pleaded guilty to 84 counts of manslaughter after its neglected equipment caused a fire in the Sierra Nevada foothills in 2018 that destroyed nearly 19,000 homes, businesses, and other buildings and virtually razed the town of Paradise, California. And as somebody who had to suffer through the wildfires of California that I believe to be nearly 100% because of the negligence of PG&E while nobody got fired year after year, I can say it couldn't have happened to a nicer utility. So, after yet another American city is burned to the ground due to down power lines, is it time to discuss nationalizing our power grid? Jen Briney.
I think it's not only time to discuss it, it's time to do it. When it comes to these private investor-owned utilities, how many towns need to burn to the ground before we realize that we can't trust them to maintain their infrastructure because they're incentivized to cut corners in order to send as much money as possible to their shareholders? It's a different incentive than a government-owned utility would have, which would be to serve the people. And when I think of like what government should do, that's always like the question for me. It's like, is this a proper task for government or is it not? For me, I think government should be doing the stuff that everybody needs and we all need on standby and we can't fund on their own. And when it comes to electricity, I think that is an essential service. It's something everybody needs and it's something we can't fund on our own. So I do think it's a proper role of government. It's essential infrastructure. And what these companies have proven is that they're not maintaining their lines properly. Like, I understand that there were strong winds on Maui, but that many poles falling down because of the wind, that is not okay. The grasslands around those lines were catching fire. And we should note that HECO, since the lawsuit has been filed by Maui County, HECO is denying that they set the second fire. They're saying it's two separate fires because there was video of the 6 a.m.-ish fire where it was definitely power lines. They were definitely live because you can see them sparking the fire. The government emergency responders went to that fire, said it was fully contained, and then went to a different part of the island where there was another fire. And HECO is saying it was a second fire that was set and that their power lines weren't a part of it. And that we don't know if it's true. However, even if it is true, let's give them the benefit of the doubt. The fact that the emergency managers did not have control and government didn't have control of those wires, the main road out of Lahaina was being blocked by the authorities because of live power lines being down. They were afraid that people were going to drive and they were going to die because they were hit by live power lines. Now, even if they weren't live, the fact that it wasn't government that was in control of that essential infrastructure was a problem here and it did cost lives. And then just on like a bigger picture, my husband worked with HECO all the time in his capacity as a solar engineer when we lived in Hawaii. And even though the island, which there are parts of all of those islands that are sunny all the time, the islands love the self-sufficiency of solar power and wind power, but HECO was constantly standing in the way because it would cost them money to change their grid. The decisions for how electricity is distributed in the United States is being taken out of the hands of the people and being given to these private companies. And again, their incentives are not in line with what the people want. And so I think it's past time. I think the fact that PG&E was convicted of 84 counts of manslaughter and still exists, it's declared bankruptcy twice. you know, if it was a private citizen that killed 84 people and was convicted of it, I don't think they would still be allowed to have that job. And yet these investor-owned utilities have absolutely no real consequences for their negative actions. So the market clearly isn't taking care of this on its own. I think it's just time that they have, they lose their privilege of profiting from our energy grid. I'm done with it.
Eaton?
Jen, I'm very glad that you're talking about incentives. That is the sort of thing that is apt to make inroads with me and people that think like me. So if we were just, you know, corporations evil, that kind of thing, it wouldn't have a lot of truck. Talking about the incentive structure and what works well for government or for the private sector, much easier to reach me. And I'm glad that's where we're starting. And I appreciate that. I am at an impasse, or not an impasse. I don't know as much about this as you guys do. I've not paid as much attention to stuff. Jen, I know that on your program, you've done a lot of grid related things, both with Texas, but also with some of the other things. So I don't know nearly as much about this topic. So I just like to ask some questions to make sure that I'm able to get my head around where we're at. When you talk about nationalizing the energy grid, it would seem to me that we could break that down into the people that are, or the producers of the energy, the power plants, the retailers that are spending or that are selling it, and the actual lines that are transmitting it. Which or all of those are you wanting to nationalize?
So I don't think the production necessarily has to be nationalized, but the transmission, the maintaining of the lines, that's what's killing people, and the decisions about whether or not to leave them live, that's what killed people in Lahaina. And then when it comes to an energy transition for whatever locals want, we've dealt with this in Puerto Rico, which is an island with plenty of sun. We're dealing with this in Hawaii, which are islands with plenty of sun. They have so many incentives just by being island nations to make themselves self-sufficient energy-wise. And because they don't own the transition or transmission lines, they're not able to restructure the grid to make that possible. That's in the hands of the private companies. So for me, I think nationalizing the actual lines themselves would be enough. And then private companies could provide the solar, the wind, the natural gas, the coal, the whatever the hell. But the transmission, that's where the problems seem to lie.
Jen, you have once again gone in a positive direction for me. If you had said, fuck it, let's have the Federal Department of Energy be in charge of all power plants across the country. There will no longer be any power plants to choose from. It will be what we say. That would strike me as a bad idea. When I lived in Dallas, I was able to select between different power producers. I paid a little bit extra every month because I took the greenest option, and I like that. Nice. I as a consumer am fairly agnostic as to whether it's private or public. What I want is cheap,
nice,
safe,
move,
and reliable.
Cuck.
I want it cheap, safe, and reliable. And I would prefer to have multiple options in terms of the power sources and have, insofar as the government's involved, dealing with externalities, safety, cleanliness, things like that, as opposed to picking winners and losers, which it doesn't sound like you're wanting to do. Excellent. So you're already beguiling me more than I thought I was going to be beguiled in this particular one.
Let me interrupt that just for a second, because if the government owns the transmission lines, so let's say like Hawaii took over the transmission lines, if the people of Hawaii decided they wanted to go full solar and wind and didn't want to import any more fossil fuels, that would be empowering the people. Like, you can call it the government, you can call it the people, but either way, that would be choosing winners or losers, because you'd be saying, fossil fuel industry, you're no longer welcome here. So that would be an effect of this. It's just one I'm willing to take.
I don't like the idea of there being a monopoly, even at a local level, really, with energy sources. But the argument that we ought to have electrical lines treated as a utility similar to roads or something like that makes more sense to me than trying to nationalize the entire system. Like in the 80s, Britain privatized their electric system because they'd previously had a nationalized system. And whenever the local union decided they wanted more money, they would go on strike. And so there were rolling blackouts throughout the country, and it had a very unreliable public sector electrical system. But it doesn't sound like that's what you're trying to do. You're mostly concerned with the lines, and it's mostly just primarily a worry that they're going to be unsafe if not run by this public utility as opposed to the private ones.
Yeah. I mean, the private ones just have a track record now of not doing a good enough job, and it's had life and death consequences for the people. And I think they've lost their, like, it's a privilege to be able to profit from the energy grid. And I think that in regards to maintaining the lines, they've proven that not only are they not doing it well, but the system has proven that it's not holding them accountable when they do kill people. And that's a problem.
That's my issue. That's my issue. So I'm open to many different solutions here. And I do suspect that this probably meaningfully differs based on different locations. I would not suspect that Hawaii's laws are exactly what California's laws or California's laws are exactly what Texas's laws are when it comes to it. Here's what I do know about utilities is that they are always inherently a private public partnership. If you are dealing with a private company to run them, even if it is just because the poles that are there are on often public land and they are given the ability to essentially have a monopoly for these areas that is protected by the government. If a startup came in and said this power company sucks, I'm going to start my own power company and start putting up power lines, the state would stop them and say, no, you are not allowed to do that. This happens with cable utilities and phone companies and all the like, right? There are rules and protections that the state gives these private companies. And my only pushback to your thought of nationalizing is, should we be rewarding a state that has already been negligent with these situations? Because that was my frustration with PG&E, is that California, the state of California, which loves flexing its state muscle, the muscle of the state for many other things that I thought were far more trivial than rampant wildfires and people losing their homes and their lives because of the lack of maintenance that PG&E was doing, was not doing what I assumed were the powers that they had of protecting a statewide, or not statewide, but large swaths of the state's monopoly on these areas, and not threatening to say, look, we will revoke that. We will make your life far more difficult if you do not get your act together, because what is happening right now is unacceptable. So my only question would be, and I'm not saying that it's a bad idea, is that are we rewarding a already failed watchdog with more responsibility? Because that I don't believe would give us a better outcome.
Well, I think watchdog and utility operator are two different jobs. And so I do question, especially with PG&E, had the voters of California had the power to demand that those power lines be buried in the mountains, we might have invested in that and been able to make that happen. But by just like giving some taxpayer money to PG&E and saying, pretty please bury the lines, it's up to them whether or not they do it. So for me, I feel like having it in government control does have some kind of pathway for them having to answer to the public and do what the public wants, which I think could lead to better prevention measures. Because again, the incentives for PG&E and HECO and for all of these other private investor-owned utilities is returns to shareholders. And so things that are expensive.
Their incentive is to stay in business, and they need to be in business with the state to stay in business.
Well, and that's a problem too, right? At what point have they failed so badly that they're no longer in business? So if we're pissed about the watchdogs.
But that's my thing. Shouldn't the state be the one that is threatening, we will put you out of business unless you correct your shit? And they don't. So yeah. If we're already there now, then why are we going to give the organization that already is not doing their job more responsibility?
Okay, because again, like my main thing is being a utility operator and being a watchdog are two different jobs.
So yes, what we're one seeing, is more important.
Well, what we're seeing is that like this structure of private company owns the lines and then government plays watchdog, their punishments are not adequate because PG&E still very much exists and is still serving all those companies. So they're failing as watchdog. But in other countries, because most other countries don't allow private companies to own their transmission lines, in other countries, they are proving that the government, when capable people are entrusted to do the job, they are able to run them as utilities. So I think they're just two different jobs. I'm advocating for them become utility operators as opposed to being watchdogs of private corporations, which it's obvious at this point that structure isn't working.
Why would you federalize it as opposed to do it on a state level? It would seem to me
that you can do it state level. I don't care.
Okay, so you're yeah. This is a public public versus private thing for you. It's not a, necessarily a federal thing, because I don't think I'd want to do this on a federal level. I think that would be too much. And the arguments in terms of where to spend the resources, where now basically Congress is making decisions on where to expand lines, I think would be a very, very bad idea. And there's no corollary to my knowledge, because the European Union doesn't have a single. Okay. So you would do it on.
Yeah. Well, and we have a naturally segregated grid. We have Hawaii that's in the middle of the ocean. We have Alaska that's basically like up near Russia. And then we have Texas, which is its own thing. And then we have two different grids in the other part of the country. So it's, I do think, I mean, you could do state cooperatives, maybe. There's different ways that you can structure this. But for me, the incentives are the problem. The incentives are either you serve the public or you serve the shareholders. And that's where I think the disconnect is.
Noting that you're speaking my language, going to structural incentives. It doesn't seem to me that if you just take it from the private sector and put it in the public sector, that it's going to be automatically fixed. I look at a variety of safety issues that happen with the government on a regular basis. I believe the largest carbon emitter in the United States is the federal government. You look at roads. Roads are publicly maintained and they're full of potholes throughout the country. So I don't think that it's automatic that if you just remove the profit incentive, that it will be fixed. Why is it that you think the government would be doing better in this scenario?
Because the government answers to the people. There's at least some kind of accountability mechanisms at the top that are done by the people. And the people could vote for things like burying transmission lines that the government could then just make happen, where they can't force a private company to make those decisions because they're inherently business decisions and not treated as infrastructure decisions. So for me, it's the ability to prevent these tragedies and the ability for emergency managers to know, because it's within the government, what has already been done by the utilities. Again, in Lahaina, the main highway was being blocked because, whether it was correct or not, they thought those power lines that were flopping around on the road were live. So if HECO did turn them off, because it was a separate entity from the government, from these emergency managers, they didn't know, and there was traffic and people died. So I just think in situations like this with dangerous infrastructure, which power lines have now been proven to the tune of hundreds of deaths to be, I think that it would be good to have them within the structure where the government could say, turn off those lines, open up that road.
I think that's, we're putting a pretty broad blanket on the idea of government to think that they're going to be that closely or more closely interconnected communication wise than local authorities and a private utility would be. I don't know. I think that this is a situation for which I don't know what the laws are or what the mechanisms are in a private public partnership with a utility between the state or city and these utilities. I do not know for sure if the people of California have voted for a lot of shit that the government is now quote unquote on the hook for, and it just never happens. And there's no recourse after that. You know, there's plenty of expenditures that have been made that just don't happen. And the government says, whoops, we're getting to it. So I do not feel confident that if there was a public referendum for the state of California with a state-owned power lines to say, bury all these because somebody's going to die, that the government would have done it faster.
But at the same time, like, the people of California voted for BART to be extended, and it's being extended. There's also plenty of examples of people voting for things and they do happen. But there's no examples of the people voting for something and then forcing a private company to do it. It's just, that's the part that concerns me. We also have to remember that PG&E blew up San Bruno. No,
California does that all the time. They vote for a private company to change the way that they do business, and they do it.
Well, it hasn't happened with PG&E.
No, I know. And that's my problem. There are levers for which government didn't pull. And so if the argument is, I had a friend of mine that had an employee, and the employee was fucking up. His entire job was just to keep shit in the store. And so my friend loved the guy. He was a really, really nice dude. And so he comes to him and he says, hey, your job is to keep stuff in the store. We ran out of stuff in the store. How about this? I'm going to get you a plugin for the website that will send you an email every time that we're about 25%. All you got to do is send yes to the email and it'll reorder everything. And then he didn't. Shit ran out in the store again. He's like, okay, you want to know what? You're probably just not focusing on it because you aren't making enough money. here's more money. And also we're going to tune up the thing, the automatic thing. So now it will automatically reorder it unless you tell it not to. And the shit still ran out of the store. So he gave him another raise. He's like, look, you're really important to this company. We really need to do it. If these things run out, we are losing money every time people come to the store. And eventually he had to realize that giving him more responsibility was not going to make him better at the job. If they are failing at a small thing, they will likely fail at a big thing. And this is an anecdotal example. And like I said before, there's a lot of different levers that can happen locally. But I just don't believe that an organization that cannot maintain upkeep right now would be better suited to keep people safe if they had more of a responsibility of this.
Well, the organization that's failing at the upkeep is the private investor-owned utility. I mean, when you look at the government, yes. Let's take this on a federal level. The Army Corps of Engineers, which is in charge of infrastructure, is a very different thing from the Justice Department. They're just two different things. And so, yes, indeed. The watchdogs, I don't know if it's because the prosecutors decided to make a sweetheart deal that allowed PG&E to continue to exist. They did go into bankruptcy. Basically, they had to pay out a bunch of fines. It was billions of dollars. And then they also got to restructure their debts. But PG&E is still in charge of all of these decisions. Yep. So that's the problem. That would be the Justice Department's failure. But I don't think having lack of trust in the Justice Department then means that the Army Corps of Engineers is incapable of doing things, because they've proven themselves to be incredibly capable of doing things. So I just think that conflating the two. Well, I mean, the Hoover Dam was built and it's still functional. So it's like we've been able to do infrastructure projects in this country successfully. And I feel like this is one that, especially, like, I will say the phrase that everyone hates, but like climate change, I'm pretty sure is real. And so if we do want to transition off of fossil fuels, these companies, they already have a grid in place that is designed for fossil fuels. And so there's also the bigger picture of, like, if we want to make a transition, if we want safer lines, and if we want to transition away from these energy sources, those decisions shouldn't be in investor hands. They should be in publicly controlled hands.
Yeah. And look, but we agree with 99% of this, but we mostly disagree. And I'm not even really disagreeing. I'm just saying that I'm not sure. You are far more sure than I am that this would be a better solution.
We are both
in total agreement to say there needs to be swift and decisive, that the government, local government, needs to have a far bigger hand than they do right now. Yeah. In the maintenance of these grids, because it was among the more disgusting things. And to be totally honest, the reason why I'm in Texas now, more than COVID lockdowns, more than the price of housing in the Bay Area, the number one thing that my wife, who was most reluctant to leave, could not get past is the fact that yearly there were forest fires. And yearly she had to deal with her asthma, with not being able to leave the house, and we could not enjoy, let alone think about investing in a place where that would happen not once, multiple times a year. And there didn't seem to be any kind of punishment from the government, for which all utilities are public private partnerships and are government protected monopolies on some level. And that's, so we are in total agreement that the government's force needs to be bigger, and it needs to have teeth, and it needs to be more responsive. We might disagree on who can run it and blah, 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 blah. But I think we totally agree on that first part. Heaton, did you have anything else to say on this, or should I transition to the mailbag?
I think you can, you know, I could quibble on some stuff, but I don't feel that I know enough about how the grid system works to really make a significant contribution. Jen, I like where your head's at in terms of looking at incentive structures rather than just making a blanket statement that corporations are bad or the government is bad. And I am not that bothered by the fact that this would at least be a localized activity rather than federalizing the entire grid, which I would almost certainly be against.
Sweet.
We're not wrong pod at gmail.com. again, we're not wrong pod at gmail.com. follow the buzzards to we're not wrong pod at gmail.com. people don't agree, they just want rights. I took a university course in comparative politics back in 2017 with a section on populism, and the key thing they kept drilling into our heads was that populism is not a political strategy or communication approach, or it was a political strategy slash communications approach first, rather than an actual ideology. So populism is a appeal.
It's a reaction.
It is not
an emotional reaction.
Well, not even that. It is a way to connect with people, not a doctrine. It is not some. Yeah.
I think that that's fair. I think when you're talking about like the ids, which, you know, determine liberalism or progressivism or conservatism or whatever, there's an id that is there much of the time. Populism is much more of a reaction, an emotion. I'm not a populist, but I do think you want a little bit of populism. I think you need a little bit of populism to keep the government honest. If you don't have populism there, you end up getting a kind of ossified, glad-handing elite. You get that kind of opaque Catholic Church sitting on the pedophilia allegations type situation, and you get the smoky back rooms. So you want a little bit of populism to keep them honest, but not a lot of populism, because you don't want populists running the show. You want it keeping enough tension to keep the thing honest, but you want an actual ideology in the center seat.
Populism to me is the emperor's new clothes. Like if the populist statement is the kid saying that the emperor's naked, everybody else believes it. It's just a thing that you believe. And that's what we find with wars or tax structures, all the things for which populism currently is a reaction against. It's a populist idea to say, wait, why are we going to war? Why are we spending all this money over there when there could be money used over here? That is, it is the common clay, the reaction, the bar stool conversation of like, doesn't make fucking sense to me. And sometimes that is a great reaction to it. And other times it's just some drunks talking.
It's good from, I think from a, it's useful analytically, but not prescriptively. So, like the song that we discussed last week on the Patreon episode, Richmond North of Richmond, is very good at being able to communicate the angst and the feeling of a rigged game that, large masses of people experience, and those feelings are legitimate and ought to be addressed. But a lot of the time, like the solution is oftentimes disconnected from the analysis with populism. So like populism also tends to be pretty anti-immigrant and view immigrants as the problem. And so, you know, low wages, that might be a legitimate thing. Immigrants may not be the problem that's causing the low wages. And so it's useful for seeing where the temperature is, but not necessarily for fixing the thermostat.
I maintain that the fact that there's so many debates about defining populism means that it's a term that's so broad and used so widely that it's been rendered meaningless and useless.
Well, I mean, again, that's what he's saying, is that this is a communication approach and not an ideology. And it's never meant to be an ideology. It is literally the ideology of populism is whatever the people are saying, which is not exactly rigid.
It's the people, the outsiders.
And by the way, friends, if you want to listen to us talk about Richmond, north of Richmond, and we are going to talk a little bit more because we got some good email about it, that's on the pot. That's on the Patreon. So 60 of you who have not yet done it, do it. We'll be at 1,000 by the next time that you talk, and you can listen to last week's episode and this week. Hear ye, writes, our country is run by oligarchs who purchased complete control over government and media. It's cute that you guys believe these choices matter and that if we all just try real hard, we might be able to elect people who truly represent us. Maybe. But we'll need to defeat a powerfully entrenched deep state who can manipulate everything that everyone hears, reads, and sees across the United States and Europe.
Yeah, don't try anything. That's the spirit. That'll fix things.
I largely agree with you, listener. I think that there's a lot of accuracy in your statement. And for that reason, my thought is the main thing you want to do is limit the size of that government that has been captured rather than trying to fix the massive government. Like, let's strip it down to what's wrong and fix that before we put more gas in the engine.
Andrew Heaton, sports question of the week. Eden, are you worried about the Josh Jacobs situation?
Not a bit. Let me say this. Josh Jacobs is a competent, outstanding sportsman. His commitment to sports, I believe, is beyond reproach. And his head screwed on tight, I'll tell you that much.
Yeah.
And that going forward, I think he is a safe bet for his team and his country. And that I have no doubt in him whatsoever. Go Jacob.
So you're not worried about the overall market that other backs are not getting the kind of fair compensation that they've been asking for?
You know, anything involving spinal cord injuries is a sticky topic. But I think that, again, I have full faith in this young man and, the fortitude of his back. Uh-huh. And also, I, now that I'm,
well, that's what he's worried about. He's worried. That's a very violent job. And he's worried
that footballer.
He is course, indeed,
as we know. Yes. Uh-huh.
And he's worried that if he doesn't get paid a long-term contract, that it's not going to be worth it for him to do that kind of job. And this is not an isolated incident. We're seeing the same thing in Indianapolis.
Mm, yes. Well, this fellow, I think, is worth top dollar. Uh-huh. And insofar as the negotiations go on with his team,
yeah.
I, for one, think he is a worthwhile footballer to invest in, and that, my God, every penny spent on him has been to the benefit of the whole organization, from quarterback to wing back to fullback, and that he will continue to impress upon the field his great glory as an American athlete.
Heaton, and this is actually off the board. Nobody sent this here, but this weekend, Labor Day, of course, traditionally the beginning of college football. Mm-hmm. So let me just go ahead and
go team.
Yeah. Let me get. Do you have any big picks here for college football week one?
Yeah, you know, I think the Sooners from the University of Oklahoma are really going to surprise people this year. I think the starting lineback is going to surprise a lot of heads, and that the defensive lineman's also pretty good. So I think all the way to the Sugar Bowl this year, and you can take that to the bank.
What if someone takes it to Vegas and wins?
Good for them.
By the way, Miami plays Miami this week. Who you got?
Probably Miami.
Nailed it. Party affiliation slut writes, if you live in a closed primary state, switch your party as often as possible. It literally doesn't matter. No one gets any extra money or points simply because of registration numbers. Donate to a Democrat, but switch to Republican and vote in their primary if they are the only ones running. Do the opposite. Nothing is stopping you.
It's true. I like it.
Yep.
Quiet, please writes, I personally hate the debate format. These things should not be in giant auditoriums with live audiences and inconsistent management. Yet here I am watching them because, well, that's how it is. And that's how it will remain as long as people want to keep going live and in person and keep tuning in. Did either of you watch the debate?
I watched maybe the first third, and I plan to watch the second two thirds. It seems salient. And also there's several people that I had no hitherto familiarity with, that I just wanted to watch and see what they were about. So I'll finish watching it.
I Jen? Did not watch it. I was at a conference and didn't want to. So, and the other
Which
thing is too,
right.
I don't vote until March 5th. So based on the way that we do campaigns here, the way that like people drop out because they don't win, you know, the four votes in Iowa. I don't know how many of them will even be viable candidates when I vote. So I'm just kind of gonna not pay attention until I have to. So yeah.
My guess would be it will be the one guy who wasn't there. I will say that it would be worth it for somebody who does not normally watch debates. If you are in any way curious about the Republican position as a party on a post Roe versus Wade abortion question, there was more done on that stage in 10 minutes than has been done in the party over the last year and change since Dobbs. We basically actually got people for whom are making their living in Republican politics, some of whom are senators like Tim Scott, that staked out the position and said, which they have been loath to go on the record saying, that some of them are for this being a states' rights issue, which had been this kind of stock position for the Republican Party. And some of them who are courting the evangelical vote saying that there should be a federal law that put it at a minimum of 15 weeks, which is beyond the third trimester, is actually fairly popular, and is where, you know, France is at 14 weeks.
You mean beyond the first trimester? You said beyond the third. It's beyond the first.
Sorry, beyond the first, beyond the first. Yeah. But it's where 98% of all elective abortions are currently. It is rare to have that. And it is around the point of fetal viability. But I thought it was interesting. It was just, you have not had politicians go out and say their points of view.
Justin, I'm with you. And actually, Jen, to your earlier point that the Republican Party and the Democratic Party have their separate cliques within them. That's true. And it's why I like the primaries, because the primaries, you actually see the fault lines between them. And in the Republican primary, like they bring up, I don't think they even brought up abortion. They brought up like taxes or something. And the governor of Arkansas was like, I'm pro-life and from a pro-life state. And you're like, great. I see where this guy is. Like you immediately could see like him. Is that Hutchinson's as the governor of
Arkansas? Hutchinson. Yes.
Asa Hutchinson. Him and Mike Pence immediately like, whoa, hold on. No, abortion's not a states' rights issue. It should be done in Congress. Whereas you have the other Republicans going, nope, this is a states' rights issue. The people of Missouri should make their own mind up, just as the people of California should make their own mind up. And you begin to see the actual fault lines there. Those are the evangelicals over there. Those are the culture warriors over there. And then Bergman, who I liked most out of the crew, will probably die in 20 minutes, I assume.
I'll tell you what. He ripped his ACL. He had a full ACL tear the day of the debate, stood up on stage without painkillers for 2 hours on a torn ACL. Like you could look at the pain on his face. He was in absolutely dire straits, but credit to him for playing hurt.
But Bergman is the
Doug Burgum.
Burgum is Burgum. The Josh Jacobs of the Republican primaries. Oh, God.
Well, I think he's probably more of the Jonathan Taylor, because we're not going to see much more of him. Like Jonathan Taylor's going to sit out. Josh Jacobs wound up getting a deal, so he's actually going to play. A Time for Choosing writes, the idea of giving presidential candidates a crisis simulation to be broadcast to the American people is a poor idea. Americans love war and they love being tough. Every crisis simulation would be, I'd bomb the shit out of that ship. The safety of the American people is my first priority. Only to be followed by the moderator softly saying, thank you, candidate. It turns out the ship was full of starving veterans.
Okay, point taken. I suggest we then move on from Heaton's war room scenario to just a full-blown goddamn bachelor-style primary system where every week somebody gets a rose or however that wretched thing works, and we just treat it like a TV show.
A serious thing that I think scratches a lot of itches and actually makes for better conversations. Make the debates a weekly show. Make the debates a weekly show and have it be two people each week. So you don't have the gang fuck on stage, CNN, Fox News, everybody's happier because they get it's just more surface area to sell ads on. And we actually get back and forth and we can kind of hype it up. Like it's a battle, it's Burgum versus Trump. It's DeSantis versus Nikki Haley. And we actually get them back and forth. You can styles make fights. So you have an evangelical with a moderate and they go back and forth. But I think that this would actually get better conversation. It would be constant. And people would want, oh no, do blank versus blank next. It would be exciting.
America's next top candidate.
I love it.
I think two candidates at a time would be a lot better. Cause for one thing, like when I watch these debates, a lot of it is rewarding the asshole.
Yeah.
Like the person who's able to speak over everybody else. Like I am almost Canadian in my politeness. And so I don't like that. And I know that whoever I like, that's like, you know, actually participating like an adult is going to get fucked over in this. So one-on-one, you'd have a much better thing. Another thing you could do. I've told you guys my proposal for the House of Resolutions, right? Have I mentioned this before?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
This is where you would put all the blowhards. You would stash all the blowhards.
The House of Blowhards. There's the Senate, the House of Representatives, and the House of Resolutions. And all they do is express the will of the American people. It doesn't have force of law. So if you just want to shout stuff and like give speeches, you run for the House of Resolutions, which is what we would all focus on because it'd be a big fuck fest for the culture war. And then the House could focus on zoning.
The Star Wars fan writes, all candidates should be required to take the Kobayashi Maru.
Hey, I dig this. Requires all candidates to know what Star Trek is at some point. Did they put Star Wars, or are you trying to piss me off in terms of how you're introducing him, Justin?
I'm sorry. I never watched Highlander. The Doctor Will See You Now writes, a much deadlier variant would this is about COVID, would necessitate strict measures, but I'm pretty sure the public health establishment has lost enough credibility that even moderates would be resistant.
That's the fear. That's totally the fear. Hopefully it doesn't happen.
All right. This one's pretty good. Just a Crush writes, I have a confession. I have a crush on Andrew Heaton.
Holy shit.
Back in 2018 or so, my best friend was like, if I could set you up with somebody, it would be Andrew Heaton. He didn't know Andrew personally, but thought that we would be a good match from what he learned in consuming some of his content. And then I learned more about him and I totally agreed. Either that, or we would just be amazing friends. We have a lot of the same interests and approaches to life. I tried to slide into his DMs, the first and only time that I've ever done something like that, but I never got a response. Then, over time, I found out we had some friends and hobbies in common, and I thought maybe our paths would cross, but they haven't yet. Every time he says he's still single on his podcast, I'm like, there's still a chance.
Yes, I have Andrew said for Eden so long
that you're going to end up with a fan. A bright shade of red right now.
I'm like a bearded tomato right now.
Do we have a city for this writer? Because we are thinking of going on tour.
They said they went on to say that this was a very, very hard email to hit send on. I have no reason to believe that it's a troll. It did seem genuine in the stuff that I cut for time. It seemed genuine, but no, there was no identifying information here. Heaton, just an out and out throwing it on the table for you. What do you have to say?
This is a thrilling development. Let us hope that this becomes a greater trend over time. Also, please don't feel bad. I'm rarely on Instagram, so I don't know that I ever even saw the thing. Also, I'll add for anybody that might be in the United Kingdom right now, I am going to be doing a meetup in Edinburgh next week on Wednesday at 7 o'clock p.m. at Wings. So if you were looking to throw yourself at me and you're currently on this island, this would be a great place to do it. Normally, the people that come up and talk to me, and I'm thrilled and I love them, but usually it's bearded guys at Home Depot. I would say that about 80% of the people that are fans of mine that I've met in real life are bearded men that notice me at Home Depot. So this is great. If apparently the amount of people that want to date me is expanding beyond that. I don't believe the gender was actually specified in this particular email, but either way, I'm flattered.
Well, and I want to put out there that when we're on the road, when we do our We're Not Wrong meetups, if you're nervous about meeting Andrew Heaton, I am an excellent wing woman who is totally down with pimping out my friend. So feel free to come up to me and I will do the introduction, because I love being proved right. And I have been telling Andrew that he's going to end up with a fan. So it's all about me and I'm willing to help it happen.
I'm happy to use Jen as the interlocutor in all of this. And wouldn't it be great if I got our whole group into trouble by sleeping with fans as opposed to playing in their D&D groups per usual?
Oh, that'd be amazing.
Somebody's gotta, you know, like that's the one thing that I've never been part of a podcast. I slept with one fan and she became my wife, and she wasn't even really a fan. She was just at a live show. So like, I fucked that up. I could have run through a solid couple dozen fans before I settled down, but no, I found Ashley first. But, I think Heaton, dude, you gotta, you know, you're the lone coxman here. You gotta start fencing with these fans, because also there's probably 11 women. Let's be honest, because you're right. Like, you know, the people that show up are they're all your pal Jennings. Like they just it is a carbon copy of a very, very well meaning bearded men with tucked in shirts.
I think I will bring some ladies into our We're Not Wrong fan base.
That's true. That's true. You bring, who knew having a woman on the show brings more women? More podcasts should do that. We're Not Wrong is a production of Dog and Pony Show Audio. Our editor is Will Saddleberg. Speaking of the debates, we have a lot on the debates on PX3. Not only did I do my full debate recap with all the sound that came from that last week, but also I did my debate, a deep dive on debate ratings, which brought me back to comparing audiences between today and 1992 and Rush Limbaugh's national network acting debut. That is involved in this show, as well as our failed candidates draft and really just going through stuff with Evan Scrimshaw of the Lions. One of the smartest numbers guys that we have on the show all the time.
Josh Jacobs of numbers.
Heaton the Orf.
I brought on Michael Weber, who is one of the smartest people I've ever spoken to. It's one of the fastest, most high octane interviews I've ever done on the Political Orphanage. He is an energy expert at the University of Texas in Austin. And a lot of people, you guys know this, a lot of people listen to our show and other shows on double speed. Like if they listen to a lot of podcasts, yeah, they'll listen to it at like 1.5 or even two times the speed. The whole episode sounds like we're doing it at 1.5 because the guy's so goddamn smart and quick that he is, as I complete my sentence, he's already seen it coming two sentences ago, bam, ready to go off. The thing lasts 45 minutes. It's a short episode. It's one of the smartest episodes that's ever been on the program. If you're at all interested in energy, if you've ever been one of those people that's been like, you know, my conservative friends say that solar power couldn't supply the whole country, and my progressive friends say absolutely it could, like, and you just want to know, he's great for that. And it's a really, really good primer on basic energy policy and how energy works. That's this week on the Political Orphanage.
That sounds awesome.
Jen,
if you listened last week, was not feeling well and was at a conference. And so I kind of surrendered my deadline for the last episode and I haven't finished it yet. I'm working on getting better. But yeah, I'm still working on a junk fees episode. So sorry, I'm still delayed on Congressional Dish.
Well, we will wait patiently with bated breath.
It'll be good when it's released, but I just need to, I don't know, sound like myself again. Do I still sound all nasally?
No. Well, you didn't sound nasally last time. You sounded smoky. You sounded like you were like a high priced madam. Like you were or a femme fatale. It was great.
You guys liked it?
Oh, yeah, for sure. You should, Jen, I think you should yell and or cry all the time. I prefer your smoky voice, and it's really good for our numbers when you sob. Look, so if you could be doing one of those things, it'd be great.
I'm just going to say, Jen, you know, I have to cut the pervy emails about you. Like, I let all the ones about Heaton go through, and I have to cut the pervy ones about you. So, yeah, keep growling.
Do we actually get pervy ones about me?
No, we don't really. Oh. We don't really get pervy ones. Although that's now sad. We'll probably get them. I thought you had a line. You had a line in the Patreon that ended a Patreon episode a few weeks ago that was like awakened things in some of the people, because there's a lot of the emails are gen fixated, and I think that they are burying a lot of different feelings considering the passion. So yeah, I would suspect that us even mentioning it is going to elicit at least a half dozen.
Yeah, I thought that comment might get a few emails.
do you recall about 8 months ago that I solicited pictures of us, pictures of you specifically, yes, as Jen Briney Storm Goddess?
Some of them were good.
Some of them were good. We got a lot of AI pictures from Midjourney and ChatGPT, and I don't think that anybody put in anything pervy, but they were very busty.
Yeah.
And some of them were borderline softcore porn. Like, I might at some point, for my own profit and gain, create Jen Briney Storm Goddess, like, pen-up poster, calendar type thing,
no,
given the amount of cleavage that was revealed in these AI photos people submitted of you.
That's creepy.
In all of mine, I look like a fucking cat with a necktie.
Till next time, we're not wrong.
Dog and Pony Show Audio.